Good afternoon. I'm Richard Phillips of Kirkpatrick, Lockhart, Nicholson & Graham, LLP, and it's my pleasure this afternoon to join with Gary Cohn of Foley & Lardner in Washington, D.C., to participate in one of the four online programs on developments in the mutual fund industry presented by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. The SEC Historical Society is a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC itself. The Society preserves and shares the history and historic records of the SEC and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. And today's program will be preserved in the virtual museum, so you can listen to the discussion or read the transcript later. Today's program looks at the entry of insurance companies into the mutual fund business. Gary Cohn and I participated in some of the developments that make up the history, and we look forward to sharing our thoughts with you this afternoon. The thoughts we express and the remarks we make, however, are solely ours and are not representative of the society or indeed of our law firms. I'm told that this is nothing personal, but as a matter of policy, the society, as well as our law firms, reserve the right to brand anything we say here this afternoon as pure heresy. And of course, anything we say here today is not legal advice. We're not here to give legal advice or investment advice. Gary, why don't you start the program with outlining the discussion that we planned for today and the background that led to the entry of the insurance industry into the world of SEC regulation.
Well, if you die earlier than expected, you run the risk of not having accumulated enough assets to take care of your dependents, and you, of course, can protect against this risk by buying life insurance, really insurance against death or death insurance that will pay your dependents the assets you died too early to accumulate. And if you die later than expected, you run the risk of outliving your assets, and you can protect against this risk by buying an annuity that guarantees payments to you for as long as you live to make up for not having enough assets. Now, these products have been regulated by the states for more than 150 years, and the industry did not take kindly to the prospect of federal regulation by the SEC in the 1960s. And the background was that the Supreme Court in 1849 in Paul v. Virginia had held that the business of insurance was not subject to federal regulation under the commerce power. Now, the Supreme Court, of course, overruled that decision in 1944 in U.S. v. Southeastern Underwriters Association, but Congress snapped back the following year and adopted the McCarran Act to assure that state power to regulate insurance would continue. And when the Securities Act was adopted in 1933, it excluded these life insurance and annuity contracts from the Act. The House report said that paragraph 388 makes clear what is already implied in the Act, namely that insurance policies are not to be regarded as securities subject to the provisions of that Act. So, Dick, it was this mindset of the industry when variable annuities were invented in the 50s. Variable annuities, of course, offer benefits that could vary with the investment performance of asset pools made up of the purchase payments and without all of the traditional insurance guarantees. The SEC in the late 50s and early 60s brought lawsuits against three life insurance companies that we'll talk about. Two of the suits were decided by the Supreme Court. Dick and I were on the SEC staff during the latter stages. The SEC won all three lawsuits, establishing that the SEC had jurisdiction to regulate the investment aspects of variable annuities as securities and the pools of assets supporting the annuities as investment companies. And thereafter, a large number of life companies register these products. When the insurance industry invented variable life insurance, or VLI, in the 60s, there was no company brave enough or stupid enough to take on the SEC by inviting a lawsuit, and instead the industry hired my senior partner, Milton Kroll, to work things out with the SEC. We filed a rulemaking petition. The mutual fund industry, represented by Dick, opposed our petition. The proceeding dragged on for 6 years. We finally got some limited exemptive rules, and life companies began selling that product. Federal regulation of variable insurance products has not been easy for either the industry or the SEC. One SEC chairman called it a nightmare. There have been two big problems that have persisted for over 40 years. First, fitting the products and asset pools under statutes that were not designed for them. The SEC described this as fitting a square peg in a round hole. And second, determining what products are and are not securities. The Supreme Court, unfortunately, did not lay down a clear test, and the SEC and some courts have disagreed on the standard ever since.
Well, Gary, this is not simply an intellectual exercise, nor a question of bureaucratic extension of power. This is really, at the heart, a question of competition between the insurance industry and the securities industry, particularly the mutual fund industry. I know you, at various times, have represented largely the insurance industry on these issues, and I have represented the mutual fund industry on those issues. And the mutual fund industry looked to the SEC to establish a level playing field. They were aware that the insurance industry was a very strong and powerful industry, having grown at the rate of about 7% a year since 1900. In the 1950s, however, things began to change as the American population became more and more inflation conscious, and they found appealing the competitive cry of the securities industry to buy term and invest the rest. And term insurance is not what the insurance industry wanted to sell because it had no investment element. Interestingly, the insurance industry viewed itself as a provider of security, not as a provider of stock market access. And it was a small upstart company by the name of VALIC, Variable Life Insurance Company of America, that was the first company to create the so-called variable annuity. And it, against the opposition of many elements in the insurance industry, as well as in the world of state regulators, fought a lone battle throughout the 50s to try and get acceptance by state insurance regulators of the concept that at least during the pay-in period of a variable annuity, one ought to be allowed to invest under the rubric of insurance, invest a large portion of the premium into equity securities. Slowly and not uniformly, the state insurance regulators bought the concept and prepared to regulate variable annuities as though it was insurance. The SEC, however, had other ideas. They thought that since a significant appeal of the variable annuity wasn't gained through investment in equity securities, it ought to be regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission concurrently with state insurance regulation. the SEC sued to enjoin VALIC, and over throughout the 50s, the battle raged in the court until it hit the Supreme Court. And in a very close 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the SEC. Justice Douglas, speaking for himself and two other justices, wrote the opinion of the court, saying that the question as to whether the McCarran Act applies depends on whether you classify variable annuity contracts as insurance or securities. It looked at this contract and said, there are some similarities. There are some elements of insurance. For example, the insurance company bears a mortality risk, both in terms of the annuitant living too long and also by virtue of the term life insurance that accompanied the variable annuity policy that was being sold by VALIC. The court found, however, that this risk accounted for only a small portion of the premium, and that most of the premium was invested in an investment fund, and that this fund was invested in equity securities. Justice Douglas held that in order to constitute insurance and not a security, an insurance company had to bear a significant investment risk as well as a mortality risk. And he found that in the case of the variable annuity presented to the court in VALIC, the investment risk borne by the insurance company was not meaningful or significant. On this basis, it found that the variable annuity in VALIC was a security and not insurance under federal law for purposes of the McCarran Act, even though the states may want to and have the right to regulate it as insurance, and the federal government would have the right to regulate it as a security. The concurring opinion written by Justice Brennan took a somewhat different tact. It applied the securities laws functionally and asked the question, what are the risks here to the buyer of a variable annuity? Are they the risks that state insurance regulation is designed to deal with, or are they the risk that securities law is designed to deal with? Is it a risk that can be dealt with most effectively by disclosure, or is it a risk that can be dealt with by solvency requirements and minimum reserve requirements? And Justice Brennan found that as you looked at and analyzed the contract, insurance regulation became less and less relevant and securities regulation more and more relevant. On this basis, he agreed with Justice Douglas and the majority of the court. This was a very significant decision, but it was not the end of the fight, because the insurance industry had other ways to deal with the VALIC opinion. Gary, what happened in the significant history of insurance company entry into the business of securities that loomed next on the horizon?
Well, a second company came along, United Benefit Life, and it offered an annuity that was a spin on the VALIC product. United Benefit tried to make its product have more insurance features and fewer investment features. For example, the payout period of the annuity was fixed and not variable like VALIC's. Secondly, United Benefit put a floor under the accumulation during the pay-in period that increased from 50% of the premiums to 100% over a period of years. That case also went to the Supreme Court. The SEC sued United Benefit, and the Supreme Court held that United Benefit's product, or at least its investment aspects, were a registrable security. The interesting thing about United Benefit is that the opinion was written by Justice Harlan, who had written a very sharp and vigorous dissent in Valak. Mm-hmm. In addition, the United Benefit decision was unanimous. And as much as I've read the opinions, I cannot see the clear reason for those developments. Now, as a more substantive matter, the United Benefit opinion says that the court granted cert because of the, quote, need for clarifying the implications of the Valak decision, which indicates that the court was less than clear in its Valak opinion. And it zeroed in on the following. The court in United Benefit said, in considering the Valak opinion to have turned solely on the absence of any substantial investment risk-taking on the part of the insurer there, we think that the Court of Appeals in the present case viewed that decision too narrowly. Now, you can read that statement two ways. When it says the absence of any substantial risk-taking, you can read that to mean that what was lacking was mortality risk assumption, as you suggested, or it can mean that the degree of investment risk-taking was too low.
I think that you can find, you can look at Justice Douglas's opinion and say, well, was there a meaningful investment risk during the pay-in period when the vast bulk of the premium went into the investment account? And I think the court found there wasn't a significant sharing of investment risk. I also think something else happened between Valak and United Benefit, and that is the court took a look at how the variable annuities were sold. And it was quite evident from the selling literature that the variable annuities were pitched to appeal to the interest of the public in gains through equity investment. And it was, I think, that additional element that may have led to the strong, I think it was unanimous, was it not? United Benefit opinion after the Valak opinion. But that's speculation, of course.
But what I would take issue with is your statement a minute ago that the Valak holding was that mortality risk-taking was required. The SEC has not read Valak to require mortality risk assumption. And it's debatable, as I said a second ago, whether United Benefit does. What happened was that Harlan, in his dissent in Valak, said that analysis by fragmentation, by taking the product apart, was hazardous at best. But then when Harlan wrote the majority opinion in United Benefit, that's precisely what he did. He divided the product into the pay-in period and the payout period and had the court analyze the pay-in period separately and found the pay-in period to be a security. He said that the guarantee was
exactly
insufficient to integrate the two promises whose operation was separated in time.
That's exactly right. They did separate the investment and the insurance elements by looking separately at the pay-in and payout period. And when you get to the variable life insurance product, it became clear that that's precisely what the SEC was doing, even though there were no separate pay-in and payout periods in variable life like there is in a variable annuity. But before we go to variable life, let me just mention the Prudential opinion. The insurance industry, I think, got tired of battling through the courts and then turned to the Commission for Relief. And the Prudential Insurance Company was the leader in this effort and prosecuted an exemptive application through the SEC in an attempt to get hopefully a complete exemption, or if not a complete exemption, a very broad exemption from various provisions of the Investment Company Act. And this effort also failed, as the SEC took the position in the Prudential case that even though the payout represented fixed guaranteed premiums, they separated the payout period from the pay-in period. They looked at the pay-in period and said, gee, the bulk of the of the premium goes into the investment account. That's the way it's going to be sold, notwithstanding the guaranteed fixed payments in the payout period, and notwithstanding a guaranteed payback of premium in the event of death during the pay-in period. The investment element was a separate element that could be regulated as a security. And the interesting part of the Prudential opinion that I found was Chairman Carey's belief that there was no reason why variable contracts could not be effectively and efficiently regulated under both a concurrent system of state insurance and federal securities regulation. And his opinion expressed confidence that that system of concurrent regulation would operate effectively to the benefit of both the insurance industry and investors. Query whether in the years since the Prudential opinion in 1963, over 40 years, that sense of comfort and optimism in the implementation of the dual system of regulation was justified. And I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go on. But the real battle, the really important battle for regulation of variable contracts occurred not in the realm of variable annuities, but in the realm of variable life insurance. That, to the insurance industry, was the important product. Annuities were always a secondary product to the insurance industries. Their business was largely life insurance, death protection, and it was in the area of life insurance that the industry was feeling the heat from the competition offered by the securities industry, particularly the mutual fund industry, in an inflation-conscious era, post-War II era. Buy term and invest the rest became a more and more popular slogan, which more and more people followed. And in order to deal with that threat, in order to feed the public's awareness of the danger of inflation and to provide them with an insurance-based solution, the industry developed the so-called variable life insurance policy. And this was not done by the marginal players in the industry. It was done by the leading insurance companies, Equitable, Aetna, and Prudential, and the Hanover, that John Hancock Insurance Company, rather than Prudential. And these three companies joined together to prosecute an exemptive application with the commission. And Gary, you represented the insurance applicants. Tell us why the insurance industry felt it was possible to get a complete exemption from securities regulation through the SEC, and what were their arguments and strategy?
As I said a minute ago, there was no individual company that wanted to begin offering variable life and take the risk of the SEC suing it. The three companies were Equitable, Aetna, and New York Life. The actuaries of New York Life had invented variable life, if I can use that term as a lawyer rather than an actuary. The actuaries had created the breakthrough, I think, with the help of the new technology of computers. and had come up with a feasible way of making the mortality prognostications that would protect the company as well as the owners. The industry came, as I said, to my senior partner, Milton Kroll, to our law firm to see how this new product might be presented to the SEC. In 1970, we approached the SEC with the idea of a rulemaking proceeding, which would be hopefully peaceful and rational and allow all interested persons to have a voice. We filed a rulemaking petition in November of 71. The SEC set the matter down for formal administrative hearings in April 72. SEC reached a determination in January of 73, which was very favorable to the insurance industry. There was a complete exemption from the 40 Act, and although not from the 33 Act, the SEC did indicate it would cooperate with developing disclosure. The mutual fund industry, led by Dick, sued for court review. SEC announced reconsideration in September 73. SEC set a second round of hearings in 74 to determine whether state regulation was a sufficient substitute for federal regulation. Reached a second determination in February 75 of no, and announced it was going to withdraw the complete exemption for under the Investment Company Act. And finally, in 1976, October 76, almost exactly 6 years after our first submission to the SEC adopted a limited exemptive rule. Now, what had happened in between was that Equitable, one of the three companies that participated in the hearing, got impatient, saw the handwriting on the wall, and asked our firm to get its product registered as a security and its separate account registered as an investment company. In order to do that, we had to fashion an application for exemptions under the 40 Act that was innovative and relied on the record being made.
As I recall, it was innovative in the sense that it was aggressive and sought a complete exemption from each and every provision of the securities laws, including the 33 Act and the Investment Company Act.
That was the rulemaking petition, yeah, not the exemptive act. Now, going back to that, to the rulemaking petition was aggressive, and Dick asked for our thinking. Our, I think part of our thinking was this. United Benefit that Dick just summarized is curious because it came after Prudential but didn't say anything about Prudential. And it went on to say that the question, I'm quoting now, paraphrasing, the question whether the separate account may be separated from United Benefit's other activities and considered an investment company is a difficult one. An investigation into the relationship between the separate account and United Benefit's insurance business, as well as an investigation of the possible conflicts between state and federal regulation, is required for a proper resolution. How could the court say that after Prudential?
But if, assuming that's so, Gary, why in the world did the insurance industry think that they would get the most sympathetic hearing on that issue from the SEC rather than the courts?
Well, we were smart lawyers. We saw that coming, and we did win the first round.
You did win the first round, but that was pure accident. Let me go back. The mutual fund industry strongly opposed the application for an exemption from the Investment Company Act as well as the Securities Act by the insurance industry for variable life insurance. The issue was very simple. Life insurance carried sales charges in the first year that generally exceeded, whole life insurance that is, that generally exceeded the first year's premium. The insurance salesman himself generally received a commission of 55% of the first year's premium, and the rest of it went to support a very strong marketing effort. The Investment Company Act, however, limited sales loads to 9% of the offering price, except in the case of contractual plans where the limit was 50% of the first year premiums and 9% over the life of the contract. The mutual fund industry felt that if the insurance industry obtained a exemption from these provisions of the Investment Company Act in particular, they would have an overwhelming and uneven competitive advantage. And it was that competitive advantage that they sought to combat with the slogan that the insurance industry, by this application, was seeking to charge more than the Investment Company Act permitted and to disclose less than required by the Securities Act. Disclose less, charge more. And that was the fighting cry of the mutual fund industry. That we tried to develop a record through the SEC hearings. Interestingly, after the hearing were over, we all filed our memorandums, our post-hearing memorandums, our reply memorandums, the insurance industry arguing that, gee, unlike variable annuities, there's no separate pay-in, pay-out period. The pay-in, pay-out periods are all inextricably intertwined, and you couldn't separate the investment element from the life insurance element. Fund industry arguing, sure you could, you just regulate the separate account, that's the investment element, okay? And most of the premium goes into the separate account anyhow. In any event, we write our briefs, and lo and behold, the staff comes out with an unpublished report to the commission, 150 pages, and adopts all of the arguments that the fund industry had presented in the hearing. A 100% victory for the fund industry. Lo and behold, some months later, the commission that was then chaired by Bill Casey, the fund industry started calling him Wild Bill Casey, because in a burst of reckless candor, and the emphasis is on recklessness, he issued a 9-page opinion upholding and granting the exemption sought by the insurance industry for complete freedom from 40 Act and 33 Act regulation. At the same time, releasing the 150-page staff report arguing the other way. It was the strangest phenomena I had seen in my years as a Washington lawyer then and even today. A regulatory agency issuing a 9-page broad brush opinion granting an exemption and releasing a 150-page staff report arguing in great detail just the opposite. Well, although the mutual fund industry was tired of this expensive litigation, and so were we, I might add, the opportunity to appeal on the basis of the staff report was too tempting. And so we appealed to the D.C. Circuit, and we filed our brief. And in the interim, while the appeal was pending, Chairman Casey moved from the SEC to become director of the CIA. A new chairman came in, Chairman Garrett, a well-known celebrated securities lawyer from Chicago. And I recall at the time that when the SEC's reply brief to our brief in the Court of Appeals for the fund industry, when the defending their decision, when that brief was due, I was going on vacation soon after. And I wanted to get working on the reply to that brief as soon as I could. And I remember calling the assistant general counsel. And I have a tough time even today forgiving him. Because I said to him, hey, would you let me know the minute the brief is available, the minute it's filed, because I want to send a messenger down. And he said, okay. And by gosh, the next day, the very next day, the commission issued an opinion revoking their earlier decision and saying that variable life insurance should be regulated under both the Securities Act and the Investment Company Act, subject to various exemptions. It was truly one of the more amazing administrative law reversals I had ever seen, and I think we'll see for a long time.
The
commission never filed that brief, and I went on my vacation, a very happy guy, but a little miffed that the assistant general counsel didn't tell me to relax and say maybe the deadlines will be extended.
But the predicate that we laid during the hearing paid off 20 years later, because the SEC threw in the towel on regulating individual fees and charges under variable products. The staff that Dick relied on turned over and produced a report in 1992 that recommended a repeal of sections 26 and 27 so far as regulation of variable products went. Dick's right. The SEC had characterized VAs and VLIs, periodic payment plan certificates, that and regulated sales loads and certain payments out of the separate accounts. During the VLI proceeding, we had argued that that was forcing a round peg into a square hole, but we did not prevail. But in this 92 report, the staff said that the SEC had jurisdiction to regulate the charges on the investment side, but not the insurance side. This was because the Congress had adopted the McCarran Act, which tied the SEC's hands in terms of regulating insurance. And the problem was, as the SEC staff said, this is a quote, its efforts to regulate some charges but not others may be ineffectual because issuers may compensate for restrictions on regulated charges by increasing unregulated charges and using the proceeds for regulated purposes. So the staff recommended that the commission propose legislation to exempt variable products from specific charge limitations. Now, the SEC, the commission itself, didn't act on that recommendation. But a few years later, who was it? Congressman Fields picked up the recommendations, and the SEC did not object when Congress amended the 40 Act in 96 to relax that regulatory approach and subject charges and fees under variable products to a reasonableness standard in the aggregate, which happened to be the standard that mutual fund fees were subject to. So it put the insurance products on a level playing field with mutual fund shares.
Are you saying that Chairman Carey was right in the Prudential opinion that, gee, a concurrent state insurance regulation and federal regulation of the securities element of insurance can exist happily, peacefully, consistently, side by side, and that there was no reason for the insurance company's concern over securities regulation? Or am I overstating things a little bit?
I think the SEC, of which I'm an alumnus, has done a good job of tailoring its regulation to the variable products. But it has been very arduous and very expensive. And as I'll quote Commissioner Loomis in a minute, query whether it was worth it. There hasn't been that many head-to-head conflicts between state and federal law. There have been some conceptual conflicts. But by and large, most of the problems were trying to fit the variable products under statutes that just weren't designed for them. But before I get into that, I do want to articulate one irony that I see. Although the mutual fund industry opposed the rulemaking petition and eventually won out after 6 years, at least that stage of it, a great deal of the money today coming into variable products is managed by the industry that opposed the rulemaking petition. What happened, I think this is interesting historically, was that life insurance companies under state insurance law invested most of the assets underlying regular traditional insurance in fixed income securities and were not expert and were not known to be expert in managing equities. So when Variable Life came out in December 75, Equitable, actually the market was down for a period of time, but it didn't really sell that well. When Hancock came out in 1980, that didn't sell so well either. And to make a long story short, the insurance industry, in order to make its products more attractive, offered as investment options funds like Fidelity and Scudder that were not sponsored by the life companies.
Right.
And the problem with that was that the life companies forewent all of the management fee. So the life industry changed that model to so that the life companies were the investment advisors, and these managers like Fidelity were the sub-advisors.
And they were basically managing another institutional account. They treated the underlying fund for the variable contract to be another institutional account. Like in the institutional account business, it's a good business. and mutual fund management organizations, as well as non-fund organizations, have competed seriously for that kind of business.
Now, to get back to Dick's question about could federal regulation live with state regulation, I collected, since this is a historical society, collecting some quotes here. Chairman Ray Garrett Jr. said, this was in 74, the commission persuaded the Supreme Court that variable annuity contracts offered by insurance companies are securities and that the variable annuity portfolio or fund thus created is an investment company subject to regulation under the 40 Act. Salesmen are regulated under the 34 Act. But the 40 Act registration has been something of a nightmare. Philip A. Loomis, our beloved commissioner, whom we both work with, said, I tend to share some of the views of the industry spokespeople. Prospectus undoubtedly was and probably is unduly complex, and the job of fitting the variable annuity into the Investment Company Act was a very difficult one. Staff knew very little about insurance. It was a long period of experimentation and learning, and looking and trying to find the right answers to problems. And in retrospect, it is quite clear that this effort was not always successful. Arthur Levitt, chairman in 1996, testified before Congress, application of the 40 Act provisions governing periodic payment plans and those products had been difficult, resulting in the regulatory equivalent of fitting a square peg in a round hole. In 1992, the SEC published a release that said the public is asked to consider whether variable insurance contracts should continue to be regulated as securities under the Securities Act. So you see that the experience was not a completely happy one. And the SEC said, should we continue to regulate?
Well, happiness is a relative thing, Gary. If I recall back in the Prudential case in the variable life insurance litigation before the commission, the insurance industry said that it could not offer this product, this variable product, which was so important to the needs of so many people in an inflation-prone era. It could not possibly offer this product if it were regulated under the securities laws, particularly the Investment Company Act. Now, wouldn't you concede, agree with me today? Can't we find some common ground that that perhaps was an overstatement?
Well, I'm not really here to recreate history. I'm here to record it. And what the SEC said in 1992, and again, I paraphrase, but there are differences between variable life insurance and variable annuities that may, quote, warrant differing treatment of these two types of contracts under that act. I mean, it sounds as if the SEC went back to the submissions we made during the hearing and maybe are sorry that they reversed the original determination.
They were very good submissions, Gary. They were just arguing for the wrong thing.
Well, you hear echoes of them now across the decades. Now, listen to this. This, again, is the 1992 SEC report. These are the questions that the SEC raised with the public. What should be deemed to be the security? Who should be deemed to be the issuer? When should the sale be deemed to occur? Now, Dick, those are pretty basic questions for an agency administering the federal security. This is just 14, 15 years ago. The SEC still hasn't got it straight.
At the same time, while the SEC may not have gotten the answers to its theoretical questions, it has regulated variable life and variable annuities. It has produced much more extensive disclosure under that regulation, and it has moderated relative to conventional life insurance and annuities the sales charges and other charges for this product. And the product has done well. I don't know what the latest figures are, but variable life insurance and variable annuities have become a mainstay of the insurance agent's package of products. It's not a sideline. It is a significant product. And it is it has saved, in my view, the insurance industry from being relegated to the sale of term insurance. But for the development of variable products, the insurance industry would have a very difficult time competing in this equity-conscious, inflation-prone world of today.
But what you left out was the cost of achieving this result. As Commissioner Loomis said, 77, ultimately what emerged was really not so bad, as you say. It was not so bad, and these investor interests are being protected, although certainly at a cost. And then Loomis said, whether the protection of investors is worth what it costs is a matter that can be debated.
Absolutely, but no one is seriously debating that somehow the regulation of variable life insurance and variable annuities ought to be left to state insurance regulation. That the primary focus of the regulation should be the preservation of financial solidarity and the maintenance of adequate high-quality reserves, which were then and are today a main focus of state insurance regulation.
But what happened was that the SEC took on the responsibility of regulating these variable products, but did not devote the person power or the resources to get it done. For example, It took the SEC 29 years to develop a registration form for variable life. You say that the states couldn't have enforced the disclosure, but we in the industry had to create the mode of disclosure in the absence of guidance from the SEC. In 1973, Chairman Casey, you called him Wild Bill Casey?
Wild Bill Casey.
He wrote to the industry and said, with regard to the form of the disclosure document to be required
under the 30,
you and your members are in a good position to propose solutions to the problems related to this endeavor. The commission strongly urges that you consider further discussions with our staff with a view to an orderly development of guidelines. I wrote the guidelines the next 2 months and sent them in, and it was 29 years, 29 years before they were reflected,
Gary,
in the Form N6.
Gary, you've made two valid points. No one has ever suggested that regulation is cheap, and no one has ever suggested that regulation is quick, although 29 years is, I think, a startling fact.
Now let me.
It was symptomatic that throughout that 29-year period, the SEC has been chronically underfunded, not just in the insurance regulatory area, but throughout most of its activities. It wasn't until the Enron WorldCom debacles that the SEC was able to get significantly greater appropriations.
Well, I think that's true, and I think the turnover on the staff that, of course, you and I experience is also part of it. When we talk about disclosure, let me just mention illustrations, because that was a key disclosure technique. When I was writing the first prospectus for Equitable, I had a choice of disclosing the theory of electricity or what happens when you flip the light switch. And we chose to follow the second approach. And we went to Alan Levinson, who was director of Corp Fin, who had the jurisdiction over disclosure at that time, and his assistant Mary Beach, called Mickey Beach. Mm-hmm. And we said to them, look, we could come in here and explain how these products work, but it's going to take a lot of pages. We can cut this short by putting in some numerical illustrations of the premiums, the death benefits, and the cash values under certain assumed rates of return.
Which is the traditional way that insurance sales products were sold.
But not variable annuities.
Okay.
Manny Coyne, for whom you and I worked, Chairman Manuel Cohen, had said that illustrations are inherently fraudulent. I could hear him in my mind saying this, because he would say, Gary, Dick, a company will never earn the same rate of return each year, and your columns are set up that way.
Well, those were the days, Gary, where the commission was death on projections and any kind of forward-looking statement. People like Manny may well turn over in their graves if they saw the MD&A and all the forward-looking statements that are not only made but are required. I mean, the world of disclosure has changed. Maybe not fast enough, because regulation is never fast, but it has changed. And what you saw was a commission steeped in a depression psychology that felt that any kind of optimistic forecast, any kind of projection, was inherently suspect and perhaps even fraudulent.
Right. And so because of that, that
permeated
think,
the whole disclosure
well,
philosophy
true,
of the
but,
commission,
but,
not limited to insurance
but
products.
But to their credit, Alan and Mickey saw the value of the illustration in promoting a shorter and more direct disclosure and did permit it.
Well, at that time, they were the Young Turks.
They were the Young Turks. And in fact, they required the illustrations in all the prospectuses. And then what happened?
Mm-hmm.
The SEC reversed itself just recently. When it adopted the N6, the SEC said, look, we got too many of these illustrations now. We wanted them in there for cost comparison purposes, but different companies have different markets. They want illustrations for different ages, different risks, et cetera. and we can't. We've lost our cost comparison. We lost the simplicity of disclosure. So now we're going to make them optional, no longer mandatory.
Well, I tend to agree with the commission on that one. You open even a mutual fund prospectus, and there's so many numbers and tables in there that apply to 16 different situations other than your own. Ferreting through that is like working through a morass. You have to be a scholar and one who likes numbers in order to get anything out of many of the fund prospectuses, and that goes with even greater force for the variable contract prospectuses.
And a third disclosure problem is the evergreen prospectus. Mm-hmm. Because as I just read, the SEC could never tell us whether the sale or the security involved the contract or the units under the contract. So did the sale take place when the contract was sold or at each time a subsequent payment for units comes in? So many companies that said, like the South when it lost to the North, said, well, fool on you, we are going to deem the sale of the contract to be the sale of the security, and each year after that, we're not going to provide updated prospectuses for the product or for the underlying fund to our individual contractor. And there are companies to this day that are doing that. The SEC has never objected, has mm-hmm. never taken a company to an enforcement action, never taken it to court. So is that the kind of disclosure scheme we want for the public? I don't know. You see, the SEC never really stepped up to the plate and decided some of these fundamental questions.
You're absolutely right, but I don't think you can judge the success of regulation by looking at the defects. You've got to look at the broader picture, and the broader picture is a variable contract business in the insurance industry that is growing, is viable, has brought important benefits to the holders, and has done so at a more moderate cost, and I think with better disclosure than would have been the case if it had been left solely to state regulation. And despite all the complaints that the insurance industry may have about SEC and federal regulation, what is this rumor I hear that the insurance industry now wants to abandon state insurance regulation and replace it with a federal system of regulation for the industry?
And that's the final
irony. And that's
irony.
The irony of this.
And that's the final reversal that we'll talk about today. And that is that the industry that fought so hard against federal regulation is now actively working for federal regulation. Now, I better add that this is not unanimous. Not every company agrees with this. But many companies believe that state regulation is outdated. Now, part of it is because both the state insurance regulators and the state securities regulators want a piece of it.
That's right.
Then there's a redundancy of federal regulation. And there's the non-uniformity of state regulation, which means it takes too long to get a product to market.
You bet. And in this global economy where speed is important, it is truly an antiquated system of having to go through 50 state regulators, sometimes two sets of regulators at the state level as well as the federal government.
So the American Council of Life Insurers is lobbying Congress for federal insurance regulation along the lines of federal bank or thrift regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Life companies would choose between traditional state or the new federal regulation. The federal regulator would be a department, preferably Treasury.
Not the SEC.
The SEC would still regulate the products. But Treasury would regulate insurance and set insurance policy. And the insurance companies think that this would protect them against the repeal of the tax benefits.
Oh.
To have a cabinet-level clout.
To have a constituency in
a
Washington.
How interesting. Would be a federal.
Well, the wheel turns. Well, Gary, this has been a very interesting discussion, And I want to thank you for putting up with me and sharing and debating our thoughts on the entry of insurance companies into the mutual fund industry. I want to remind our audience that today's program is now archived in the Society's virtual museum. You can listen to this discussion again and again and again, if you choose, at any time, or you can read the transcript later on. Our four-part series on developments in the mutual fund industry will resume next week on Tuesday, March 29. Marty Leibecker of Wilma Cutler Pickering Hale & Dorr will moderate a discussion on the development of money market funds with John McGonigal, Vice Chairman of Federated Investors, Inc., Robert Plays from the SEC's Division of Investment Management, and David Silver, retired president of the Investment Company Institute. Please join us at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and thank you for being here with us today.